Good afternoon, you're listening to 90.7 FM. I'm Franklin, and this is Berkeley Grox.
That's right, it's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives. I'm Charles Lee.
Coming up on today's show, traffic lights, RNA, and contraceptives.
In addition, we'll be joined by Craig Newmark, who will discuss Craigslist.
Also, we'll find out what gamma rays are.
So stay tuned for all this, plus the Grokatron 5000 and the world-famous question of the week, coming right up here on the Berkeley Grox Science Show.
Back to Berkeley Grox, I'm Frank Ling.
And I guess that makes me Charles Lee. How are you doing, Frank?
Very good. And we have a very special guest today, right?
Indeed we do. We've multiplied again, and I'm not sure how that happens all the time, but so it's Dr. Laura Munoz.
Hi there.
Hey, Dr. Laura.
We're really looking for some interesting science advice, especially from Dr. Laura. So you must know everything that there is to know in science, right?
Sadly, no.
Okay, how about traffic?
I've been doing some research in that area, yes.
Okay, so I'm just wondering, you know, every time you go past those lights, there's like a little camera. How do you know which are the ones that actually film your car when you go through a red light or something like that?
There are a number of applications that cameras might be used for, not just photographing you.
Warrantless wiretapping, I think, is what they're used for nowadays.
But basically, your car is monitored wherever you go. Like, the government has a record of where you're going anytime it wants to, right?
Well, I don't think they're to the point of continuous monitoring everywhere. The urban area, I think in Berkeley, for example, you see that there are cameras and other sensors sprouting from some of the downtown locations, but not continuously everywhere. Another application of cameras is to actually just collect data. So
traffic flow?
Yeah, to take traffic flow measurements and not necessarily to snitch on you when you've run a red light.
Okay. And how about those pressure pads that they have right before the crosswalk? What exactly are they trying to measure there?
There might be pressure sensors at various locations just to indicate it's what you expect, I'd assume, the presence of a pedestrian or a vehicle.
And does it change the light?
Yes,
the
I think that's the idea. Well, if it's not hooked up to anything, that's kind of confusing. What it should do is inform the control system or computer that's at the roadside that someone's waiting or a car is waiting and needs the permission to proceed.
So how do we destroy all the other traffic in front of me so that I can just get going to where I need to go?
Well, I guess there's a number ways you could do that, involving explosives, artillery, but I'm not sure you'd like the consequences. But you'll also have to consider the problem of removing the debris from your path once you've created it.
You just need the turbo boost, and then I can just jump over the...
Oh, right. Just like Knight Rider.
All roads lead to Knight Rider.
So they have these mythical things called the blue box or the gold box, or whatever, where you can control the traffic signals. Are those real devices?
Oh, I've never heard of that. Blue box, gold box?
Apparently, so above like all these signal lights, they have little sensors, infrared sensors, and some of them, if it picks up a certain signal, can be continuously red or continuously green, or in case of some emergencies. A fire truck could aim the signal and then basically have all blue lights all the way.
Imagine there are emergency bypass systems. Usually there's a control cabinet located nearby each signalized intersection, but I don't know if it's blue or gold, like you say. I think some of the ones you see are gray, for example, so it just looks like a big metal cabinet. And as far as I understand, that's where the main computer or computers generally residing.
So, know where to take them out.
Well, maybe I've been fed some propaganda to try to misinform me and everyone else, so that won't happen. I don't know.
If Berkeley Grox is nothing else, we are a source of misinformation.
What about infotainment?
Well, I don't think we're ever entertaining. Oh. And certainly we don't have any information.
Okay. Well, aren't we entertainers pretending to be scientists?
I think your true mission is to educate it.
I don't think we had a mission, I guess. Oh. So now that you've defined it, now we actually have a purpose in life.
Isn't that painted on the side of your car or something? It's kind of like the police to protect and serve, educate, and inform.
We've never protected anything.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a police, not you.
The side of my car is a big 01 and the sign saying the South will rise again.
Oh, how charming.
Yes, well.
Aren't you from Arizona?
It has a flag of Prussia.
Oh, okay.
I think I mean South Korea, so that's perhaps that South, or maybe Antarctica.
Yeah, because... Is there anything else you'd like to know about?
Well, you're off on your way to Columbia, I understand.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the consensus. It's actually Cornell. So the first two letters are similar, and the state is right. But I think Columbia is in New York City, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay, and Cornell is in the middle of nowhere, right. Otherwise known as Ithaca, New York.
Well, I think if by consensus people are saying you're going to Columbia, maybe you should just go there, right?
Yeah. If there's a consensus, then
you
be
must
right.
Follow the consensus.
Yeah, and when I show up at Columbia, they'll understand.
Of course.
Everyone told me I was going here.
So it must be true.
Yeah.
But Ithaca's very pretty, though. It has many gorges.
To jump in, I guess, when things are not so pretty.
Well, right. I've heard the weather can be rather inclement.
It sort of makes up for its own lack of towering buildings. I'm not sure how that works.
Okay, so if you add up all of the positive and negative heights,
yes,
magnitude has to be past some threshold.
I really have no idea.
Okay.
I'm not sure where I was going with that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
We're glad that you're here, and we have new correspondent for the Berkeley Grox.
Happy to be here.
In the future, we'll hear more about all the fascinating things going on in
the world of traffic flow modeling.
Traffic flow.
Okay, great. Thank you for this opportunity.
It was our pleasure.
So, Charles, what do you do for that time of month?
Usually I throw a party.
Oh, okay.
Because parties are good.
Oh, you don't bleed then, huh?
No.
Apparently that's becoming an option for women, though.
Bleeding?
To not bleed.
Well, to bleed or not to bleed.
That is the question, right?
Whether it is nobler than mine to suffer the bleeding or not.
So, apparently many young women now have the option of taking these continuous contraceptives. Many of them actually guarantee that you will not bleed more than 4 times a year.
So, how does it guarantee that? Does it stop ovulation, or?
More or less. For many women, what they already prescribe is the pill. They just take continuously, or whatever device they're using, they exchange more regularly, and so that prevents the period from even happening.
Okay, that's a plus.
Yeah, but apparently there's a very hot market for new contraceptives, which will just work for months and months without giving you periods, without even giving you any mood swings.
Are they developing these type of contraceptives?
Oh, there's actually several coming to the market. All the major drug companies are working on it, but at some point it may become the norm where a woman not having periods at all.
I think men should start actually having periods because symmetry, right?
Got to preserve
conservation of period. So what's the news here then?
Well, this is just a trend that will probably prevail.
Okay. If people want to know more about this trend, or if people are looking for these type of drugs, where can they take a look?
Major website. One of the containing druggists called Season Ale, which is getting pretty popular these days.
Season Ale? It sounds like a microbrew.
It's just that good, you know.
Well, if it tastes good and stops a period, man, I'll drink it.
Very nice article on LifeScience.com.
All right, finally, I guess rounding up the stories for the week, we have RNA.
RNA.
Go, go, go. Be DNA.
We don't need DNA.
It's overrated. Wasn't there this theory that originally it was an RNA world?
And then there was also a protein world, and somehow they collided, and at some point DNA evolved to bridge the gap between the two again.
DNA, it's like Switzerland. Researchers are actually using RNA as a therapeutic mechanism now to combat certain types of disease, viral diseases in particular. What you can do is you can use RNA with suitable complementary sequences to bind to genes you want to suppress and silence.
You mean genes in virus or?
The virus might be expressing, or even your cells might be expressing, that you want to silence and turn off. What you do is you basically create a hairpin in your complementary RNA, and this prevents transcription, translation type things from occurring.
Oh, okay.
So this is actually a big avenue of research for therapeutics, but it turns out a new clinical study is showing that this type of therapy may be lethal.
Does it get out of control and start turning everything off?
In the sense that it kills you, yes.
So what, you lose all the necessary enzymes that you need?
It's actually overwhelming the cell's own microRNAs, which are similar tiny molecules found in most cells. And so if you override these normal functions, it's probably not going to be healthy.
Uh-huh.
And probably you're shutting off all kinds of things you don't really want to be shutting off.
Yeah, don't screw with nature.
You know, nature's evolved very complex mechanisms. And here we're tweaking one small little circuit by bashing on it with a hammer. So maybe not the most elegant solution. Most scientists suggest we shouldn't give up approach just yet. We're just going to have to do a lot of clinical trials to make sure that any type of short hairpin RNA therapy is safe.
And if anyone's interested in a hairpin therapy,
go to your local barber, or perhaps take a look at this issue by Dirk Grimm at Stanford University, and it was published in a recent edition of Nature.
And that's all for a look at current developments in the world of science and technology this week. This is Berkeley Grox you're listening to here on 90.7 FM. In a few moments, Craig Newmark of Craigslist joins us.
Welcome back to Berkeley Grox. Well, today we have someone very special who has actually affected my life and probably many of our listeners. He's none other than Craig Newmark of Craigslist. Mr. Newmark, thanks so much for joining us today on Berkeley Grox.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So I guess just to give us a little background, maybe you could tell us how you started Craigslist and what it means to you.
Basically, in 94, I saw a lot of people helping each other out on the net. Comes 95, and I decide to give back a little bit, just telling people about arts and technology events. And since then, we ask what people want, we do what we can, and then we ask again. It feels pretty good to have helped out a lot of people.
Great. And I understand one of the concerns you have these days is the whole notion of building trust and communities on the web. And certainly Craigslist has, you know, brought many people together through events and whatnot. What are some of the challenges right now to bring more openness to the web?
I think people are being pretty good about being pretty open in general. I think the major problem we have are this, that of people who post disinformation on the net to either sell something that's bad for you or maybe to cover up other bad stuff. People are overwhelmingly good and trustworthy, and we just need ways of dealing with the bad guys.
I guess on a lighter note, what are some of the more amusing things you've seen on Craigslist?
My favorite still was the guy who posted an ad for someone else to take the CPA ethics test for him. Aside from that, people are finding lost dogs on our site, and people sometimes are finding lost stuff, like in Boston, someone lost an iPod, someone got it back to them. And finally, people manage to find their partners on our site. Misconnections often really works, not very often, but sometimes, and that feels good.
So aside from Craigslist, you're also interested in citizen journalism, and could you tell us a little bit of your efforts in that?
Well, I don't distinguish what I'm doing from between citizen journalism and, let's say, more professional-style journalism. It's all a spectrum, uniting the two perspectives, I think. I'm working with Dan Gilmore and his work, his nonprofit, trying to figure out just what's going on with participatory journalism. I'm working with some of the groups doing heavy-duty investigative journalism, trying to help, although we're trying to figure out what that means. I'm even involved in a startup in New York, the purpose of which will be to help people find the most trustworthy versions of big news stories.
Yeah, which brings the question, how do you know the news is real? I mean, you mentioned that there is also disinformation out there, but at the same time, there's also the whole notion of the wisdom of the crowds in the sense that it can filter out the misinformation. How optimistic are you? Do you believe that the wisdom is there?
People are generally pretty good. Maybe not in the short run, but people are good at smelling out scams, and not just financial scams, but news ones. People are good at that. We just need to attract enough people to get interested in these things, and then to have people get track records in the form of online reputation. And I think as long as there are ways of dealing with the bad guys, then I think we're going to get something evolving to do the job. But it's going to take some experimentation. First efforts won't go all the way to fixing this. Maybe as much as 80%, but it needs to be closer to 100.
So I understand that you get some of your news from The Daily Show, which a lot of us certainly enjoy, and despite its irreverence. How do we know that that is the real news?
There's no way sometimes to be sure, but a show like Daily Show or Colbert Show will do things like the investigative journalism showing, say, a politician saying one thing and then saying another thing. And it's hard to deny when they show video, which a lot of people have, so we know it's not fake, and that's some of the best reporting they do.
So I guess we're running a bit of time, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us here today.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Well, Mr. Newmark has kindly agreed to join us on this week's edition of the Grokotron 5000, the computer formerly known as Deep Blue. And today the topic is trust or control. And here are five subjects, whether they're trustworthy or control freaks. Subject number one, Movie star Tom Cruise, trustworthy or control freak?
Suspect.
All right, subject number two, celebrity of a similar but more television type, Oprah Winfrey.
Seems to be okay, trustworthy.
Subject number three, Star Wars character, Jedi Master Yoda.
Trustworthy.
And subject number four, Microsoft chairman, Bill Gates.
Track record, not so good.
Bit of a control paranoid maniac, huh?
Microsoft keeps promising and... has difficulty delivering.
All right, and subject number five, our perennial favorite, the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Trustworthy or control freak?
I have every confidence in President Bartlett.
Mr. Newmark, thanks so much for joining us on this week's Grokotron 5000.
Take care.
And that was Craig Newmark from Craigslist we were talking to. This is Berkeley Grox here on 90.7 FM. In a few moments, Margaret Thorne joins us to talk about new projections in global warming. So stay right here. Welcome back to Berkeley Grox. Well, the truth may be inconvenient, but it may be more serious than we think. With the release of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, global warming is once again in the minds of the public. Scientists have struggled to quantify the consequences of global warming. While it is understood that human activities through the use of energy releases these greenhouse gases, earlier models have neglected the release of CO2 and methane gases from positive feedback in addition to anthropogenic sources. Well, joining us today to talk about these feedback loops is Professor Margaret Thorne, here from the Energy and Resources Group at UC Berkeley. She's also a scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories, where she investigates climate change. Professor Thorne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's nice to be here.
First of all, could you just summarize some of your journal findings from the paper that you and Professor Hart had published in Geophysical Review Letters?
Yeah, sure. John Hart and I have been working on a project to look at how ecosystem feedbacks or the response of the Earth system may amplify the warming that human activities are causing. So we've looked at what past data can tell us. In the past ice ages, CO2 and methane, which are the most important greenhouse gases under human influence, went up when temperature went up. And it shows that when there was a warming event, Earth processes changed in such a way that they actually emitted more of the greenhouse gases. And the same thing can happen in the future with anthropogenic warming. Now that human activities is releasing CO2 to the atmosphere and causing warming. That warming can trigger changes in oceans and land processes that actually amplify our warming by emitting more methane and more CO2 to the atmosphere. So what we did in this project was attempt to quantify that positive feedback to warming.
To understand, your models rely on the GCM, or Global Circulation Model. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Global Circulation Models, or GCMs as they're called, are, as they say, global models that use the basic physics, conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, to model Earth's climate in a fairly sophisticated way. And they're coupled with the ocean and ocean circulation. And they predict, with a doubling of CO2 concentration, they predict between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees warming, that's degrees Celsius, for a doubling of CO2. But these models don't include greenhouse gas feedback.
Okay.
So they don't include the fact that soils, warmer soils, may decompose more quickly and release more CO2 to the atmosphere, or that melting permafrost in the tundra could release more methane. So the global circulation models right now don't include the full suite of greenhouse gas feedbacks. That you do see those greenhouse gas feedbacks, though, in the paleo record, in the ice core record.
So these emissions from the soil, do these include the massive reservoir in Siberia?
Yeah, so the Siberian and the Alaskan tundra contain large amounts of methane in the permafrost, and a melting permafrost could release that methane and greatly accelerate warming.
Under these models, once this process starts, is it reversible, or will we have to wait for another geological cycle before we can get back to the state that we're in?
I think many of these feedbacks would eventually run their course. In other words, there's only so much methane in the tundra that could come out. So although a positive feedback is a bit of a runaway cycle, it wouldn't go on forever.
Mm-hmm. I understand carbon dioxide and methane are your primary greenhouse gases. Are you also including soot and other minor molecules?
No, we weren't. As you mentioned, soot or aerosols can act as either cooling or warming. So they have a rather complex but important effect on the climate. But we didn't include those in our analysis.
Are these factors that you'd like to include in future models?
I think our main emphasis right now is to try to get the full suite of greenhouse gases into the GCMs, into the general circulation models. Mm-hmm. And there's one professor on campus, Professor Inez Fung, who is pioneering getting CO2 feedbacks, mainly terrestrial ecosystem feedbacks, and some ocean CO2 feedbacks into the model, into the models, I should say. And it's not yet, we don't know the mechanisms of these feedbacks well enough to include them in the GCMs yet. But as more is known, then people are including them in the models. So certainly soot and aerosols have to be included, but that wasn't our focus.
So I understand the data you relied on were from samples in Antarctica. Maybe you could explain a little bit how those data got translated into data for your model.
It's quite a remarkable piece of work. People are going to the Antarctic and drilling very deep cores into the ice and bringing that intact ice core back to France or back to the United States for analysis, and they're analyzing the gas that's trapped in little bubbles in the ice, and from that extracting CO2 and methane concentration at different times. These ice cores allow us to look back at the atmosphere 720,000 years ago in very fine increments. Mm-hmm. We looked at the last 360,000 years of data, and from that we could estimate how much CO2 and methane concentrations went up for a given amount of warming. Then we combine that, this is an analysis of the ice cores, we combine that with GCM, what's called climate sensitivity, or how much warming you get for a doubling of CO2. So we had one half of a feedback loop from the ice cores. Mm-hmm. That was what the impact is of warming on greenhouse gases. But from the current GCMs, we got the other half of the feedback loop, which is how much an increase in the greenhouse gas affects temperature. So we put those two things together, and we use mathematics from operations research or circuit engineering, actually, to estimate the feedback gain. And maybe I should say what we kind of numbers, because we found a significant amount of warming coming from these feedbacks that we're not yet estimating. Mm-hmm. For example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, currently estimates that we could have a warming by as much as 5.8 degrees Celsius by the end of the 21st century. But if Earth responds as it has in the past, we wouldn't actually just be committed to 5.8 degrees warming. We would actually be committed to 7.7 degrees Celsius warming. So
because
2 degrees,
of the feedback.
Because of the feedbacks, gives you another 2 degrees Celsius extra warming commitment. So it's actually quite a lot.
I mean, the thought is a little bit scary.
It is. I like the paper, but I was very sorry about the results.
So I understand that even if we stopped all emissions today, all greenhouse gas emissions, the planet's still supposed to rise in temperature by, say, 1 or 2 degrees in 50 years. Do you have perhaps a little bit more refinement to this notion?
What you said is correct, that even if we stop emitting more greenhouse gases now, we've already put enough into the atmosphere that we're committed to probably another half degree warming. Mm-hmm. And that's because primarily the ocean system hasn't fully come into equilibrium with the new greenhouse gas regime. And it also takes a while for CO2 to be scrubbed out of the atmosphere. If we increase CO2 by 1 ppm now, it can take up to 100 years for that increase to go away.
I see.
But methane is a little bit better. Methane has an atmospheric lifetime of 10 to 14 years.
Okay.
And it will go away much more quickly.
Have you looked at, say, you know, how human practices, perhaps, say, you know, planting trees on a large scale or sequestration, how that would affect these models?
Well, clearly the most important thing we can do is to stop emitting greenhouse gases and to stop combustion of fossil fuels for everything, for changing the way we do transportation and get electricity.
Right.
And that's the most important thing we can do. People talk about sequestration as a bad idea whose time has come,
mm-hmm.
I say, and that there can be some short-term benefit, I think, in sequestering CO2 in geologic reservoirs if they're stable and,
right.
and well-managed.
Right.
And that's a short-term interim fix. It's not the long-term answer by
right.
any means. And then planting trees, I think, can only be done where that's a good idea for other reasons. The pressure on fertile land is so great, and
right.
and the pressure on water supply,
mm-hmm.
which you need to grow plants, is
mm-hmm.
so great that I think we can only think about using trees or forests for sequestration where we have other goals, like conserving biodiversity. If you want to protect a tropical forest to protect biodiversity, then by all means, get a little marginal benefit from keeping the carbon in the forest and not
right.
in the atmosphere.
Are there any lasting thoughts you'd like to add about your current work or this paper?
Well, I was surprised at one result, which was just its impact on me, that since I wrote the paper, I've actually been more alarmed about climate change than I was before, even though I've been studying its impact for
mm-hmm.
19 years. Got me out of my car. That was a big thing.
Great. Well, Professor Torn, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for coming here.
Yeah, thank you. It's great.
And we were just talking to Professor Margaret Torn here at UC Berkeley and scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. Her paper, co-authored with John Hart, is now available at Geophysical Review Letters, the May edition. This is Berkeley Grox you're listening to here on 90.7 FM. In a few moments, we'll find out what gamma rays are, so stay right there.
Now it's Jimmy Molson here from 1930s Radio. It's crazy. It's amazing. It's the miracle of radio straight to your home, but it's not coming in on gamma rays. What are they? Well, they're the most highly powerful waves there are in the electromagnetic spectrum. Can you believe it? It's as great as John D. Rockefeller's choice of Standard Oil.
And Kal-El with this week's question of the week. When you have heard this, our planet has been destroyed for many years. But what is Krypton made of? If you know or think you know, email us at grox@hotmail.com. You won't win anything, but you know you are sent here for a reason. And that's all for this week's edition of Berkeley Grox.
Make sure you tune in next week for more from the world of science and technology.
If you'd like to contact us here at Berkeley Grox, you can email us at grox@hotmail.com. For Berkeley Grox, I'm Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee. Make sure you also see us on the web at www.grox.net. Have a great afternoon and stay tuned for more music.